Frank Ostasevsky talks about emptiness and clinging during a Skype talk in Sandpoint, Idaho, 4/16/14.
This evening I would like to talk about emptiness again, but emptiness and clinging and how these two go together. And my hope is to try and make it accessible and something that we can digest and use in our everyday life. Yeah? So to try this impossible task, you know, to try and do this, I'm going to use the help of some friends, among them Jack Kornfield and Norman Fisher, good friends who I admire a great deal, both wonderful speakers on the subject, and also a scholar monk, Tanisara Bhikkhu from Southern California, and maybe a couple of others, we'll see. But, first we'll start with Jack, and Jack is a wonderful storyteller, so he starts with a beautiful story to illustrate non-separation, really. And it goes back to the Emperor of China. And the Emperor of China apparently asked a renowned Buddhist teacher if it would be possible to illustrate the nature of self in some sort of visual way, in some sort of visible way. And in response, this master, who must have been quite brilliant, he had a special room built. And it was, if you have to imagine, a 16-sided room, right, that was covered from floor to ceiling with mirrors that faced each other exactly. So if you can imagine such a room. And can you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, good. So, at the center of this room, the 16-sided room, covered in mirrors, he hung and lit a small candle. And when the emperor entered, he could see that the individual candle frame, he could see it reflected in 1,000 different images. Yeah? So you can get the picture here. Then the master, the Buddhist master, replaced the candle with a small crystal. Yeah? And so the emperor could see that the small crystal was again reflected in every direction. And when the master pointed closely at the crystal, the emperor could see the whole room of 1,000 crystals were reflected in the tiny facets of this crystal. And by this, the master showed that the smallest particle could contain the whole universe. Yeah, that was the image. So you can sort of see how this works, right? So the reason why this story is helpful is because it's very hard for us to understand the concept of emptiness. That's how it's usually translated, emptiness. And so we think of emptiness as some kind of void or vacuum in a way. But really, here we're speaking about emptiness as the capacity to contain all things, yeah? And this mysterious, in a way, and pregnant void, really, reflects all possibility. And from it arises individuality, you and me, which can be discovered and developed, although never really possessed and fixed. And if you think about that, you know, just think of yourself. You're not a fixed thing. You've been changing all of your life. You need only look at your hair color to understand that. Yeah. Right? So like this story of the mirrored room, self is held in non-self or in non-separation, just as the candle flame is held in this great emptiness. Now, let's come back to our real world, not ancient China. And I find often when I'm working with Westerners that they're a little selective about their receptivity to certain aspects of Buddhist teaching. For example, we can feel a certain alignment with the teachings on the first two of the three characteristics. The three characteristics, remember, are impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, And the third is often called emptiness or non-separation, non-self, right? So the first two kind of make sense to us, and so we readily accept them, right? We know that everything changes. We can easily see that in our life. And so we recognize that things appear and disappear, that things come together and fall apart. Yeah? Now, so that's really easy for us to get. Not hard to swallow impermanence. And in a similar way, we appreciate certainly that there's suffering in the world. There's no shortage of pain and difficulty and unsatisfactoriness in our lives. And we can even appreciate that when we resist the truth of impermanence, there's some degree of suffering. So we get the second characteristic pretty easily. So impermanence and suffering. However, we kind of hit a stumbling block when we get to this third one. This teaching of, in the Buddhist term is anatta, or non-separation, or emptiness. It's translated in lots of different ways. My favorite translation is actually boundlessness. And it's hard for us to really get this, you know. Most of us, those of us sitting here tonight, appreciate the promise of happiness that's part of the Buddhist teaching, yeah? But if we're really honest with ourselves, if we tell the truth, we imagine that we will experience this happiness as a separate me. And we kind of like the idea that I'm going to get happy, yeah? And through our joy, though our joys and sorrows, this sense of I starts, remains a kind of foundation. And when we look at the experience, we often, if we're honest, we actually kind of see ourselves at the center of things, you know? It's like we're looking at reality through our eyes. And although at times we understand we're not the only thing in the universe, sometimes we imagine we're sort of sitting at the center of it. Like those t-shirts, you know, that you see. So the idea of having to let go of I or me is pretty frightening, actually. And our little ego, our little sense of self, can't do it so easily. And the truth is, probably most of you sitting there right now, if you were really to be honest, it's pretty hard for you to believe that there's no I. Now, let me say something right now at this stage of the talk, because I think it's important. You don't have to believe anything. I don't want to ask you to believe anything. I want you to test it out in your own experience. Okay? All you really have to do is practice with sincerity and interest, and things will become clear to you. But I want to point you to some possibilities. So most people imagine, most of us sitting here, imagine that if we were to let go of what we normally think of as I, we'd fall into some kind of bottomless void, and there would be no happiness, there would be no real enjoyment of life, yeah? So don't worry about that, okay? Just continue to practice mindfulness with sincerity. But if you can, tonight, keep an open mind to some of what I'm saying, okay? So as we practice, we cultivate gradually, and you've already found it in your life, some kind of balance. We start to see a flavor of balance showing up. You know, we're a little less reactive with our spouses. Maybe we're, you know, don't get as upset, you know, at one of those telemarketers when they call. We start to find some kind of balance in our life. And as we do, we're inclined to keep practicing and to really start to see, well, what are the causes of unhappiness and the causes of happiness? And gradually what happens, and you're even getting a flavor of it already, is we extricate ourselves. We see through the causes of unhappiness. And when the practice gets deep enough, or deeper than it currently is, we start to even see through the illusion of separateness. And what happens, not as a matter of belief, but as a matter of insight, is that what starts to arise is a kind of discernment, and we could say wisdom. And with this wisdom, as we spoke last time, comes a deeper understanding of non-separation, and arises compassion. So let's explore what a few other people have to say about this. So there's a wonderful teacher down here in the Bay Area who studied in both the Zen and Vipassana traditions. His name is Gil Fronsdale. He's a wonderful teacher. If you go to his website, Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, you can find an incredible library of talks by Gil and many other people. It's an amazing resource. And Gil has this unbelievable purity, which I really admire in him. And he also happens to have a Dharma center in the middle of Silicon Valley, where there are all these type A's, you know, who are there. And these people, without Gil really saying anything, recently just purchased and built or rebuilt a beautiful Dharma center. Beautiful Dharma center. And I was down there a few weeks back, and it's just a lovely place. And what's beautiful about this Dharma center is that it's completely run on Dana. There is no fee for anything, no fee even for room and board. You pay what you can afford to pay, just like monasteries in Asia. And it's one of the few places in the country that operates this way. And I think it's arisen in part out of Gil's purity. In any case, this is what Gil has to say about his own practice and about this this quandary of emptiness. Yeah. And he said, having tasted a degree of peace early on, which came from the simple practice of present moment awareness, I took up intensive Zen training. He studied both here and in Asia and Japan, and then later did Vipassana practice in Burma. He says, as soon as I found that this peace was elusive, I encountered a deep sense of guilt and insecurity and suffering. You know how it is? We feel some contentment and then it seems to slip away, right? He said, I was shocked at how self-centered I was and how painful the self-centeredness could be. And because the only practice I knew was to be mindfully present, I spent a lot of time, both in formal practice and in my daily life, trying to have a settled sense of presence with my suffering. Then that's all he did, right? He just tried to be aware of his suffering. He said, years later, I realized that doing this, I was slowly being, he calls it, compassioned. Yeah? And he said, my resistances and my defenses eventually relaxed, and in their place grew a certain tenderness and kindness. And it was a process that seemed to soften the crust around my heart. Isn't that a beautiful description? Of the kind of gradual awakening, you know, he just with sincerity just tried to practice mindfully. And gradually, he said, over time, he was compassionate. It was a beautiful expression. Let's go back to Jack Kornfield. Jack was interviewed by Shambhala Sun magazine once, and he was speaking on self and no self. And he was being asked to respond to our stories about a false sense of self, you know, and how we could get rid of this. That's what the interview was asking him. And Jack is really smart, you know. He's both a really great meditation teacher and a brilliant psychologist. And so he answered, he said, it's not so simple. He said, to get rid of the self, if to imagine getting rid of the self that everything will be fine, he points out, he said, for one thing, he said, the concept of self and no self is a kind of false dichotomy. It would be more accurate to say that there's an unhealthy attachment and a healthy attachment, which can occur in relation to both the experiences of emptiness and in relationship to our sense of self. And then Jack went on, he said, both self and non-self, the personal and the universal, are legitimate. And they're legitimate dimensions for practice. And one is about honoring and respecting what is unique about us, and the other is about letting go. I thought that's such a simple beautiful way of holding this, you know, that you don't have to choose self, non-self, you know, but rather that we practice with both, the personal and the universal. Remember we spoke about absolute compassion and relative compassion? Okay, here's a more scholarly take on this by the monk Thanissara Bhikkhu. Bhikkhu means monk. And he's a brilliant mind. And he said this. First of all, he goes, when somebody asks him the question, he goes back and he sets a context. And he said, the first thing we have to understand is that all questions, the Buddha divided all questions into four classes. Right? And I thought that was an interesting way to respond. And he said, the first of those were those that deserve a categorical, straight yes or no answer. So that's the first group. Second, those that seem to deserve an analytical answer, something that we have to tear apart a little bit and explore. He said, the third, and you see this when you read the Buddha Suttas, one that deserves a counter question. Often when the Buddha was being asked a question, he'd ask a counter question. And fourth, those questions that should just be put aside. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. He said, so instead of answering no to the question about whether there was a self or non-self in the time of the Buddha, whether this was interconnected or eternal or separate, the Buddha felt that it was a misguided question and it should simply be put aside. Why? Because the Buddha's teaching dealt with one really important thing, and that was the cause of suffering and how to relieve oneself from suffering. And he didn't think this question would necessarily get us any more free of suffering. So he says, Thanissara says, if you develop the path of virtue and mindfulness and discernment and use the calm state to look at experience in terms of the Four Noble Truths, the question that occurs in the mind is not, is there a self or what is myself, but rather, am I suffering because I'm clinging to a particular experience? And is it really me? And is it really mine? And is it really myself? So that's the important question. What's the cause of the suffering, right? And if it's stressful or a cause of suffering and it's not really me or mine, why hold on to it? That's a really great question to ask. That's useful. Real transformation arises from nonverbal action. You know, when we're fully present and we're able to pay attention in a sustained way to our experience, we can begin to see directly, in an uncolored, obscured by our ideas and our concepts, yeah? So placing our trust more in loving attention and less in analyzing can allow space for a new way to hold the question. And that's what Thanissara is suggesting. So much time, you know, we worry about questions like, you know, death and self and non-self. And what we realize in some of these questions is it's a sign that we're too attached to finding the answer. Okay, here's one more commentary, and it's by Rick Hansen, a friend who's also a psychologist, done a lot of work on neuroscience. And Rick summarizes it this way. He says, self and suffering are synonymous and caused by clinging. And clinging to what? To what are called the five aggregates. So he says, when I'm saying self, I'm not speaking philosophically, I'm talking about the normal conventional self that we normally identify with. So self and identity are used interchangeably here. And he says, when we're clinging to a sense of separate self, we've imposed this idea on the natural openness of awareness. And so we sense a sense of limitation. And whenever you experience limitation in awareness, It's a self-imposed limitation. Let me say that again, because that's actually central to everything else we're talking about. Whenever you sense an experience of limitation in awareness, it's self-imposed. We're imposing it. Awareness isn't by its nature limited. Okay? So, I want to just explain one more thing. Aggregates. Rick used this term, aggregates. And aggregates, well, think about geology, okay? There's something that's composed out of small elements and held together with a kind of binding medium. So in Buddhism, we talk about certain aggregates, material form, feeling tones, perception, mental formations, and consciousness itself. And these things come together and hold, make solid, or make an aggregate out of our thoughts, basically. So, let's see, how can I explain this to you? Okay, one last story, and then we'll talk. There's one of my favorite stories in all the Buddhist texts is about this guy. His name is Bahia of the Bark Cloth. Bahia of the Bark Cloth. And he's this guy that has a dream, basically. And in the dream, he's supposed to go to the Buddha to understand something about his life and awakening and all of that. And so he arrives to see the Buddha. When the Buddha is on his alms round, when he's going around begging round. And he asks the Buddha to teach him the Dharma, and the Buddha declines him twice. But Bahia, and you have to imagine this guy with, he hasn't cut his hair, and he's really long, you know. He could have been living in the woods of outside of Sandpoint, you know. He's wearing nothing but bark. This is his outfit. You know, he just takes bark off trees and strings it together, and this is his outfit, right? I love this guy. He reminds me of, you know, some wild man out in the woods, you know. And so he goes to the Buddha, and he asks him, he says, will you teach me the Dharma? And the Buddha twice sends him away. He says, no, I'm in my alms rounds. Don't bother me now, you know. But Bahia, you know, asks him a third time. And there's an old thing in the scriptures or the suttas, that when a teacher's asked three times, the teacher must answer. And so basically, in a way, I always get the feeling that to get the Bahia off his, you know, get him to quiet down, basically, he gives him this really simple teaching, which turns out to be the pith instruction, the simplicity of all of the Buddhist teaching in like a few words. And he says to Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there is only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sense, only the sensed. In reference to the known, only the known. This is how you should train yourself, Bahia. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. Just this is the end of stress and unsatisfactoriness and suffering. That's his teaching, yeah? And as the story goes, upon hearing these words, Bahia, you know, is immediately released from his suffering and is awakened, like in all good Buddhist tales, and goes on to be an arhant, you know? All right. I was just teaching with my friend Norman Fisher for the last few days, a wonderful Zen teacher, and he was talking a little bit about this. He was talking about the sutta on mindfulness. And I asked him, I said, how do you sit, Norman? And he said, well, basically, he said, I sit down and I just rest in emptiness. He said, my breath goes in and out. And the breath I share with everybody else in the world who's lived and who's ever lived and is now living. And I feel it like a great rhythm, he said. It was a beautiful way of describing it. You know, we talked last time that wisdom and compassion are like the wings of the great bird, you know, two wings of the bird. And so Norman said, you know, when I sit like this, I realize that there's nothing but love. This is how he put it. He said, just sitting like this, really simply, just watching my breath come and go, resting in emptiness, the thing he comes to realize is not some esoteric teaching, but that there's nothing but love. He said, nothing but love. He said, but the problem is that we don't understand this. We don't really know this. He said, we're deeply ignorant of this one thing. And it's the one thing that we shouldn't be ignorant of. He said, ignorance is unfortunately doesn't mean that we don't know. It would be better if we didn't know. He said, ignorance means that we know something and we hold on to it very firmly, but it's the wrong thing. We are so sure about our sense of self, and we're kind of blinded by that, and we hold on to it so tightly, but it's the wrong thing to hold on to. He said, so ignorance is not knowing, is not not knowing, you know, in the sense of being open. He said, ignorance is misknowing. It's a beautiful way of understanding it. All right, last quote, and it's by a non-Buddhist. It's by one of my favorite African-American teachers, George Washington Carver, you know? Beautiful, beautiful teacher. And he wrote this. He said, anything, anything will give up its secrets if you love it enough. That's what he said. Anything will give up its secrets if you love it enough. And so that's what all of this is about in the end, you know. This kind of we can have very esoteric understandings of emptiness. But what Norman's pointing us to and what Jack was pointing us to is you don't have to choose between self and non-self. You just have to be willing to sit, to see it clearly, without getting caught, without being too attached to your view. And simply love what's presenting itself. And if you love anything enough, as Carver says, it will show you its secrets. That's the beautiful teaching, yeah? Beautiful teaching. Okay, I know that's a lot to take in, and maybe too much for a warm Wednesday evening, but I wanted to point us a little bit to this so that we could keep exploring our understanding that we started with last time about compassion, that, you know, compassion is arises out of wisdom, out of clear seeing. And happiness arises out of clear seeing. When we see through our ignorance, you know, how we've misknown something, then happiness is just there waiting for us, you know, happy to show itself to us, really. So all of this is to try and encourage you to begin to look at and be willing to wrestle with a little bit this third characteristic, impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and the third characteristic of anatta, sometimes translated as emptiness or non-self or boundlessness. And to really look at this, because this is really the heart of the other two. This is really, you know, the misknowing of this, the ignorance of this, keeps us stuck in the cycle of difficulty and suffering. Yeah? Okay. I'm going to pause now and pause this recording as well, so that...